Yes.
I didn't realize
right? No, no. I wish it was running when you were talking.
Oh,
it's April 4th, 2006. This is Ellen Norrie. I'm interviewing Miss Grace Madison for the history of SIUE. Yeah. You have some questions, didn't
yes,
you? Yes, good.
I have them here.
Good.
I took a look at them.
Here, give them to me. I should
okay.
make a
oh,
copy.
You don't have a copy.
No, no, I have it on my computer, but I didn't get back
yeah.
from this other.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this is how I usually start out, your memories of being a student and, you know, anything you think is significant.
Yeah. Well, we moved to Alton from Minneapolis in 1963. And it was my husband and four children. Children were between the ages of 7 and 15. And in 1964, I started taking classes.
Mm-hmm.
My husband had told me, if you want to take a class or two instead of playing bridge in the afternoon, that's all right, but don't try to get a degree. And I translated that into don't neglect the family.
Sure.
So, I started out taking one class that I thought was a fairly strong
mm-hmm.
strength of mine, an English literature class, and I was able to pass that, and so that started me.
Did you have any previous college?
Yes, 17 credit hours from the University of Minnesota
mm-hmm.
from 22 years earlier. Were transferred, were accepted
mm-hmm.
as transferred.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very happy about that because I don't know whether I would have had the courage
mm-hmm.
to take entrance exams.
Mm-hmm.
I was 40 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Right out of high school, I graduated from high school in 42, and the Pearl Harbor attack was in my senior year.
Hmm.
So most of the boys in our class were drafted, and
uh-huh.
the girls were anxious to do something.
Sure.
Some of us went into defense work, and I went into nursing. And I chose to get my nurse's training at the City and County Hospital in St. Paul.
Mm-hmm.
It was called Anchor at that time. And this was a large hospital, 800 beds, and ambulances coming in every 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was wonderful.
Yes.
It was exciting.
Yeah.
And our first quarter was spent at the University of Minnesota, taking classes all related to nursing. I think one at a junior level and the others at freshman and sophomore
mm-hmm.
levels. And I remember there was a shortage of nurses, as there
mm-hmm.
always has been, and the war wanted nurses. So we were really pushed to study hard and to make it. And I remember the professors at the University of Minnesota were very much available to help. But
mm-hmm.
it was a very rigorous time. However, I was a little surprised that all 17 credit hours were accepted. I was pretty happy about it.
My daughter's a nurse.
Oh, is she?
Yeah, she's a nurse practitioner.
That's great. Yeah. At the time that I took nurses training, they didn't have degrees in
mm-hmm.
nursing.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until after the war that the University of Minnesota started their program, and they made an offer to us, to our nursing
mm-hmm.
class, that I think for one or two more years we could get our bachelor's
mm-hmm.
degree. Well, I wasn't interested in that at that
mm-hmm.
time. And, so when we came to Edwardsville and I started back at school as a non-traditional student,
uh-huh.
I didn't know what to expect. And I was quite happy that this was a commuter college instead of a residential,
mm-hmm.
that many of the classmates were first-generation college students.
Mm-hmm.
And so for all of us, it was kind of an unknown.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I was very well accepted by the younger students. I was surprised at that. I thought I'd stick out like a sore thumb. In high school, I had thought I was quite tall.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went back to school and I looked around, most of the 18, 20-year-old kids had towered above me. And so I felt a little more normal, too. But I did, I was quite careful at the beginning of what I took, and I worked very hard in studying. After a little bit, I thought, well, I probably should look at the things that would be very difficult for mm-hmm. me and take some of those and just see if I could pass them. Well, they had a required course of algebra in the general mm-hmm. studies program, and I had never taken algebra. It wasn't offered in the small high school I went to. I had taken geometry, and in geometry class I had a very patient teacher who, when we would have tests and have to prove theorems, my proof was never quite like the textbook, but he would go through it and he'd say, mm-hmm. yes, mm-hmm. that it's just another way of thinking of it.
Uh-huh.
So when I was faced with algebra, it seemed to me there aren't any two ways of doing this, you know? And I wasn't at all sure what would happen. But SIU had a remedial algebra mm-hmm. course at that time. It was 5 hours a week for no credits. And I took that and only that for one mm-hmm. quarter. And we had a wonderful teacher, Jane Broadbrooks, taught it. And she loved math, was very good at it, but she also had several children and was very patient and an excellent person for mm-hmm. someone who really needed a lot of help. We had workbooks, and I went through the workbook, and some students didn't get quite through it. I made it all the way through. But it was all stuff I had never had before,
mm-hmm.
instead of being remedial. And once I had passed that, or gotten through it, I thought, okay, now I'll take that algebra course. And I managed to survive. It seems to me that course was early in the morning, which was not a good time for me. And it seemed to me that all the other people in the class were very smart about algebra.
Mm-hmm.
But I got through it and got it off the list. So then I thought, well, what are the requirements for a bachelor's?
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed logical to take the general studies first. Mm-hmm. Usually that was it. So I started kind of filling in the blanks. And then I did that for a couple quarters, I think. I was taking about two classes at a time. And then the Vietnam War was on at that time, mm-hmm. and some of the young men in the class were having student deferments.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of one of my classes, one of the boys in the class went up to talk to the professor, and I overheard him saying something about having trouble keeping up. And he said, there are some people in this class who are only taking one or two classes, and so they have lots of time to study, and they can zero in mm-hmm. on this, and I'm afraid I'm losing, mm-hmm. you know. And it hit me like a ton of bricks.
Mm-hmm.
I had been working real hard trying to keep up with them, and
yes.
all of a sudden I realized that maybe by studying that hard and all, I was sending someone else
uh-huh.
to their death, possibly, mm-hmm. a life or death thing. So I really felt guilty, and I thought, well, what can I do about it? I suppose I could drop, that mm-hmm. would be all right. Or, and this really sent a light bulb on in my brain, I could take full course.
Uh-huh.
So I started going full time. My study time at home was usually after 11 p.m., I could, when everybody else was asleep and the phone didn't ring or anything,
mm-hmm.
and I would study for an hour or two, and that several times a week.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one genetics course that I took. I was very interested in genetics, and mm-hmm. and it fascinated me, and we had I think we were having a midterm, and we thought, and there was a lot to read and to study just before the exam. So I remember that night I sat down and I thought, I'll take a couple hours to study. Well, the time got away from me. It was after 4 o'clock in the morning when I finally closed the book. Hey, I've got it. So I went to take the test, which was about 10 o'clock in the morning. And I looked at the test, and it was all familiar. And I turned the page. Yes, everything was there. I knew it perfectly. Oh, I'm going to ace this. This is great. Mm-hmm. Sat down to write. Well, a few days later, we got our papers back, and I had a B minus. Oh. And I looked at it. That can't be. I knew everything. So the answers were one or two sentence answers. I looked at it. At the beginning, everything is clear and fine. And then, probably partway down the first page, a few of the first words in the sentence were fine. And then it just went off to scribbles. And I looked at it, I couldn't believe it, and I turned it over. Sure, other things, every once in a while, there was I was falling asleep and not knowing it.
Oh.
I was writing, I was so tired. And I would start writing, and I knew what it was, but what got down there was just scribbles. So anyway, I went home and consoled myself, actually.
I mean, B minus isn't too bad. I bet a lot of people got less than that, though.
Well, maybe, but this was a subject that I thought I'm really flying with. But anyway, I consoled myself with, you should go to school to learn, and grades are just keeping score. So I've never regretted it, but it's the first and probably the only time that something like that has happened to me, and I didn't think it was possible. I wondered about grading. When I first started, and we were still going to classes at Shirdla in Alton, there was this big lecture hall, and this was a physics course, which also was not my long suit. But I think it was a large class. I'm thinking close to 100 students, may have been 80 or so, but large. And in this large class, and it had a stage, and the professor stood on the stage and lectured. And the professor was someone from India with a very pronounced accent and fast talking. Now, I had lived in Pakistan for a couple of years, and this was not completely foreign to me. And so I was able to follow, but I remember just taking notes fast, trying to keep up with them. And I sat in close to the front so that I could hear them. There were difficulties with hearing, acoustics weren't too good, and all of that. And after the midterm test, he said that he was going to assign seats to the students. And he took the grades that we'd gotten on the midterm tests. The person who got the best grade, he had quite a few of the seats vacated, the first several rows, so that he could reassign them. And he took the person with the best grade got the best seat. And et cetera, as probably a reward thing. But I sat there and fortunately, this is another time when I had worked hard and I was okay in that class. But I thought about the people who really needed to hear him the most, who were having the most trouble, were put in the back where they really didn't have a chance. I mean, it just cut them out. And I think I heard that class ended at Christmas time, and I remember hearing that that class had just been decimated for grades, that over 50% had failed. And I thought, this isn't good. If I had taken that as my first course, I think I would have quit.
Sure. I thought you were going to say the opposite, that the poorer students would be seated in the front.
Well, it seemed to me that would be fair. Yeah. I could understand that.
Yes.
But no, it was this other way.
Oh,
and
weird.
And I think the fellow who was teaching, I don't remember his name or anything, but I think his reasoning was that people who are here to learn, that I'm serious about this, and people who are here to learn, I want to be sure they get it. Mm-hmm. And the people who aren't, forget them, you know, and it, that kind of thing, which kind of, mm-hmm. I suppose, is one way of doing it, but it seemed very unfair to me. And then, in contrast to that, when I was in graduate school, I was taking a psychology course from Robert McLaughlin. Do you remember him at all?
I've heard of him.
Very nice fellow, laid back, friendly. Everybody loved him. And all.
How do you spell his name? M-C?
And then capital L-A-U-G-H-L-I-N.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And anyway, he was a very sensitive person, I thought. And this was kind of a seminar class. It was mm-hmm. would be very difficult to mm-hmm. grade it. You know, you have to be very subjective. And towards the end of it, I remember, I'm sure he was struggling with how to grade it. And at that time, SIU faculty had gotten together and had decided that there had been grade inflation,
mm-hmm.
that they wanted to strengthen the standards and that they had to grade a little harder.
Mm-hmm.
So here he is, faced with this dilemma, and he asked us, he said, okay, everybody take out a piece of paper and write on the piece of paper the grade you think you should get. Well, we were all psych students, uh-huh. and we were all kind of friends of his, and we all kind of looked around and smiled. Everybody put down A, you know, uh-huh. as if more or less, this is your problem, teacher,
yes.
you know, kind of thing. And he got them back, and he looked at them, and then he looked at us. You know, that was another way of doing it, but it was no help at all. I understand now that there's a trend toward, instead of marking on the normal curve, mm-hmm. which was what was done then, to set up objective standards and goals, and any student who surpasses that, you know, gets mm-hmm. a good grade, and they don't worry about the distribution. So
mm-hmm. that's true, I would say.
Is it mm-hmm. in essence now you could have a class that got all A's and mm-hmm. it would be fine, but at that time it wasn't. If you were in a class where your classmates were very knowledgeable, your grade was competitive mm-hmm. and went down. Let's see, what else do you want to know?
This is all very interesting.
Oh, is it? Uh-huh. I could go on and on.
Yeah.
You had something in your notes about the campus.
Yeah, the buildings, I
yes,
said.
Yes, and I remember, because I started in Alton, and then when the campus was very new, I believe there were three buildings to
uh-huh.
start with.
This is in the fall of 1965.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this is also the year the arch was built. I mean, there was so much happening at that time, and I thought it was wonderful, a new campus, a new arch and whatnot. But there was a temporary cafeteria in the bottom of the mm-hmm. library, and it had some vending machines. Most students, I think, uh-huh. brought a brown bag lunch, and a little sparrow got in and was perched up in the ceiling. And as I remember the ceiling, there were some beams and all there.
Mm-hmm.
Nice place for a little bird to make a nest or to stay there. And so the bird was there for at least 2 weeks or so before anybody could catch him. And when anybody would get a cup of coffee from the vending machine, and this was very frequently, when they would take their cup away, it would still drip a little.
Uh-huh.
And the bird would swoop down and take a drink. So when anybody went to the coffee vending machine, we were all watching. As soon as they left, the bird would come down. And sometimes someone would try to catch it, but the students thought of that bird as a fellow creature, and we're all in this together, trying to survive. And
oh, that's
you know,
a wonderful
so
story.
It was just a friendly kind of thing. After a few weeks, somebody caught it and got it out. But see, I always thought the campus had a beautiful natural environment. And at the beginning, there was a Japanese landscaper who I think did an excellent job. And the favorite place for me over on campus at the time for studying was on the second floor of the library, where you have that solid wall of glass, solid wall of glass, a wall of glass that looks out over, well, at that time there were young trees and you could still see parking lots, but it was so quiet and so nice and peaceful, and I thought, oh, this is a wonderful place to study, and overstuffed chairs and whatnot. So I really thought the campus was wonderful. There was one drawback when you were parking out in the student parking lot and coming up over the hill, and it was very cold. There was a chill wind that really hit you, and a lot of the students complained about that. But also, another thing I thought they did very well when they started up the new campus was they didn't have paths designated. They waited for a couple of years and then saw where the students went to get into buildings and then put the paths there, made them permanent paths. And I thought, you know, this is really nice. I think in any educational institution, it's good to see the student come first and sell them the way it happens.
That's right.
So, let's see. Oh, I took a biology course and I was surprised. I had taken biology 22 years before, but half of the book was all new. DNA had come in. All of that. And then there was a philosophy course taught by John Breuer that I thought he was an excellent teacher. And I remember one of the times before class when we were waiting out in the hall for another class to end, I overheard two rural farm boys who ordinarily had been talking about mundane things from the farm. And then they started talking about the difference between Socrates and Plato. And they were talking about it so earnestly, and, you know, they really had had understood. And I thought, this is wonderful. This is what education should be about. And the art, the hanging art in the Goshen Lounge.
Plum Bob.
Is that Plum Bob? Okay. I was there when the boxes were delivered that it came in. It came in several boxes, great big cardboard boxes, and carpenters came to open the boxes, and I think they were expecting to put it up. And they opened the boxes and looked inside and started pulling out these dowels with strings attached, you know, and finally closed it up and decided to get someone else to check out how it was supposed to go. It was pretty confusing. And I understood at that time that if you pulled on any section of that, the others all moved so that it always made a very nice art form. And you could change it by pulling on one string. I'm not sure whether that's been done or what about it, but that was something I thought was great. And of course, the Rodin's Walking Man in the library, and the students putting shorts on him. I thought that was pretty good. This was during the Vietnam War when I was back, and other schools were having riots and sit-ins and whatnot. And one day, a group of students, maybe 15 to 20 or so, had gotten up a list of demands And they went into, I think it was Chancellor, I believe it was Rendleman mm-hmm. who was in at the time. And they went into his office, or where his secretary was, and presented the demands and told her this was a sit-in. So she told them that he was out of town at a conference, but she would call and see if she could get through to him. And she invited them to sit down. They all sat all around. And she called, and they said that he was in a meeting, but in about half an hour, the meeting would be over, and he would be glad to call back and take a call. So she told them that, and the students all sat down and waited. And while they were waiting, she offered them cups of coffee, and they sat there drinking coffee. And then the call came, and she went over the demands one at a time with mm-hmm. the chancellor, and he told her some things were already done, they just hadn't been announced to the students. Uh-huh. Some things were being done, and I think there was one thing or so that he said, you know, that's a good idea. We'll go ahead and do it. So anyway, the secretary relayed all this to the students. And the students washed up the coffee pot and the cups, and they went out. That was the sit-in at SIU, a little different than some.
Were you one of the students?
No, I wasn't. I heard uh-huh. about it, but I wasn't. I think they were all younger students. Probably some of them on draft deferments and all, mm-hmm. but yeah. And I always thought in some universities they were having bomb scares and things, and would mm-hmm. have to lock down some of the buildings. And, uh-huh. and I thought, okay, if that happened at SIU, where did I want to be? And I decided it was the library. If I had to be locked in for a while, I wanted it to be the library. And the library had this section for magazines. Mm-hmm. And they were all on display where you could see them. Just go there and you could see all of them. And they were arranged in alphabetical order, A to Z. Uh-huh. And I never had time to really read magazines. I was mm-hmm. too busy with studying. And I thought, okay, if I had some extra time, I'd like to go in there, and I'd start at A and go right through to C. And so I was kind of looking forward to a lockdown or something, but it never happened. I did take the war seriously. I had two sons who were in college about that time. This was the last few years that I was taking classes. And they were very much involved in some of the unrest.
Mm-hmm. Where did they go to?
Our oldest son started out at the University of Michigan. Mm-hmm. He was a merit scholar, and they were trying to change their image from being this great football school to being academic, uh-huh. so they really wooed uh-huh. the kids. But it wasn't the school for him, and mm-hmm. and he transferred to Knox College in Galesburg.
Oh, yes.
And I think that's probably where he was when much of this happened.
Mm-hmm.
My second son was at Stanford, and mm-hmm. there was a lot going on there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I was probably there when your son was there as an undergraduate.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, there was a lot going on.
Yes.
Malcolm X came, and Martin Luther King came. And
oh, yeah.
Yes.
Here's another thing when you mentioned Martin Luther King. J.F. Kennedy was assassinated soon after we came mm-hmm. in 63. And then Martin Luther King, and then Robert Kennedy. Uh-huh. And I was taking a class, I think it must have been a sociology class, and again, there was a day of testing, and I think it was maybe one or 2 days after Robert Kennedy
in June,
had been assassinated. Was it? Okay, so
June of 68.
It was right after that. And I don't know, these assassinations have really hit me pretty bad. I just, what is the world coming to kind of thing.
Yeah.
And the test was set for a certain time, and I evidently somehow got it in my mind it was an hour later. And I know my daughter was out of school then too or something, so she came over on campus with me, and we were sitting there visiting, waiting for, the door was closed in the classroom, I thought there was a class there, and waiting for me to go in and take the test. And so my mind was completely on other things. And someone came out of the room, and I said, "Oh, is your class finished?" And he said, "Class, this was a test." So I went in, and I thought, "Oh my gosh, am I going to even be able to take this thing?" You know. And I remember apologizing to the teacher, and then telling her, "I said, you know, this last assassination just threw me for a loop. I mean, you know." And she looked at me as though, "You expect me to believe that? Well, here's your test. Go ahead, you know." And I don't know whether I had a limited amount of time or I just limited myself because I didn't want to keep her longer. So I went ahead and quickly wrote the test and all. But I thought of that later on when I was teaching in Florissant Valley Community College. I taught some beginning psychology. And some of these students, most of them, I think, were non-traditional, but most of these students had excuses that at another time I would not have believed at all. But after what I had gone through, I thought, look, you know, this is probably true. And and so I changed my mind a little bit about what's an acceptable excuse. Oh, and then there was one class I was taking, a psychology class about Carl Rogers. And I don't, a lot had been happening, and I was finding it difficult to concentrate on what Kathy Skinner was the lecturer then, and my mind would wander, and I was concerned about the war. I was concerned about a lot of things. And she started talking about Carl Rogers' theory of, I'll call it psychotherapy. There's, he has another name for it, unconditional love or unconditional regard or something. It turns out, and she mentioned the word empathy and all, and in the meantime, my mind was going off to civilization should be advanced far enough so that war is obsolete. And I thought, you don't need to solve problems by violence anymore. We've progressed beyond that, and battling with those two things in my mind, and my brain kind of put the two together as she went through Carl Rogers' theories and all, and off here we should be able to all be friends, shouldn't have to fight. And I came up with something that I later called the empathy game. And when it came time for my, then I took another class where it was with a bunch of student teachers, and we were supposed to make a project, a teaching project. And of course, I didn't intend to teach any grades or anything. So I thought, well, maybe I should develop this empathy game, teach empathy, you know. So I did. I carried it further and actually made a model and cards and whatnot went with it. And that was rather well received. They showed all the projects to the other members of the class. And then when I went to do my thesis, my advisor suggested that I write down several options and then we'd talk about which one. So I put that down as one. I could do research on this. And he said, "I think this is the one you should do." So I did my thesis on it. And then I had another class with a psych professor, I don't remember his name, who had written several articles for Psychology Today, a popular psych mag. And Psychology Today was having a section, probably two or three pages, of puzzles and games and whatnot, all related to psychology. And so I asked him, I said, "Do you think they might be interested in my game?" And He said, you know, they might. But he said, if you submit it to Psychology Today, be sure and get it copyrighted first.
Okay.
Because they copyright their magazine. Mm-hmm. And if yours isn't copyrighted, they get the rights to it. Mm-hmm. So I thought, oh, okay. So he referred me to the attorney for SIU, mm-hmm. Who was Coffee
Gilbert.
It's the senior.
Okay, Coffe.
Oh, Coffey. Yeah.
Ey. Yeah.
I don't remember his name either.
No,
he made out a will for me. I have it along in a file someplace. But anyway, so I went to him, and I said, I've been told that I should get this copyrighted if mm-hmm. I submit it. And he said, well, because this has a three-dimensional piece, game piece, to a scoreboard, I don't think this can be copyrighted. I think it has to be patented.
Mm-hmm.
So he referred me to a patent lawyer over in St. Louis. And I went over to see him, and he readily took it. He
uh-huh.
said, because in doing my thesis, I had done all the literature search
mm-hmm.
and all, you know, so it wouldn't be
yeah.
too difficult. And so I have a patent on that.
Oh, you do?
Yeah. I got it, let's see, what's the date? My son had made into a plaque. He said, Mom, you shouldn't just keep it in
yes.
the book. So I have a very nice walnut plaque here. Thing on it. The
let's
date
see.
Is, let's see, what's the date on there?
71,
the
date is October 9th, 1973.
Oh, 73
uh-huh.
is when I got the patent. Okay.
Oh.
Yeah. It took a while.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I think I graduated in 71, so this uh-huh. was after, yeah. Yeah. But, and then later, after I had used it in that manner, I thought, well, maybe this should be put out for general use,
yes,
general public, you know. It
uh-huh.
had to be made, instead of the research model I had, it had to have some, you know, more interesting things.
So did you send it to Psychology Today?
You know,
after you
I
did
didn't.
All this?
I didn't.
Oh.
This was taking a long time, and I was out working. I after I got my master's, I had a year with the nursing division on a special project.
Uh-huh.
They were trying to develop some help for. A three-year diploma
mm-hmm.
nurses to transfer into
mm-hmm.
SIU and get a degree.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was working on that with them. And I did use the empathy game then for some research with some of their nursing students.
Mm-hmm.
Did a little project with them along with the other work. But I never did. And I don't know quite why, I just
mm-hmm.
kind of moved on. But then my son helped write some other things. I hired him. And he set up a thing with stationery and business cards. We called it Gateway Games. And there was a teachers' meeting in St. Louis, and I was asked to exhibit it. And
mm-hmm.
to put it in with another exhibit that mm-hmm. had some other things. It was a peace group. And Marianne McGivern
yes.
in St. Louis. Do you know? Okay. Anyway.
Yes, Marianne McGivern. She's a nun.
Yes.
And yes, and she
and
does
very
all
much
the,
interesting
she used
in
to
peace.
Be on the public radio all the time. I really
yeah.
looked forward to her.
And she I decided I'll put this out for a few people and
mm-hmm.
get feedback from it.
Mm-hmm.
And she was one of the people who wanted it and who took it. And she
uh-huh.
Somehow, maybe she was the person who contacted me about exhibiting it.
Then. Uh-huh.
And I did. I just put it in. I wasn't there
uh-huh.
at the time. But anyway, there were these other things happening.
Mm-hmm.
And then a friend of my son was a graphic artist who had worked with a game company. So he made a box and all, and He had access to an engineer who made another better-looking score thing. I think I have that. I went through this stuff yesterday. Let me get that off. But I burned out of it.
You burned out.
But
oh, that's
I wasn't interested in the marketing of it. And I had contacted several game companies. And your established game companies are most interested in in-house things.
Uh-huh.
They'll accept your ideas, but then they take them and they're house people do it. So
did you play it in your family?
Yes, I did. And you know, the research model, which was not really interesting, but and I thought it had possibilities. And on my thesis, as I think most theses say, you know, this was good, this wasn't good, more research needed, etc.
Yes.
This is the way it went. But anyway, then, and after I got the patent on it, then there is a company that keeps track of how many times this patent is cited.
Uh-huh.
And they send you cards saying your patent has been cited so many times.
Uh-huh.
Would you like to buy an abstract or something about whoever is doing it, you know, to network? And it started out, I think they sent a card and said it had been cited four times. And I thought, well, I'm not interested in doing a lot more on it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then it finally got up close to 100 times before they stopped sending me the cards. I never did buy any of their stuff. But evidently, there was some interest in empathy.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that somebody used some of the information. The patent was for 17 years. And so, so it would have run out, what, in 90?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
You didn't renew it?
Oh, you can renew. Oh, no. I wasn't interested in keeping other people from knowing about it. In fact, my thinking about it, and this maybe is strange, but this, I figured I had gotten enough use out of it.
Uh-huh.
I had done my thesis. I had used it for a project, you know. But and I just thought, well, I hope somebody takes up the ball and runs with it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Scruples came out, that's another thing that is quite well known and all.
I've never heard of it.
You haven't. Well, anyway, my kids are often kind of looking for things that are they think might be from my empathy game or something. And one Christmas, my daughter-in-law brought that, and she said, "Grace, I think this game is like yours. Did they take it from you or something?" And I looked at it, and at that time, we were still developing this, thinking we'd do something with it. And I thought, well, wait a minute, maybe they were there first.
I don't know.
So I inquired about it, and I found out that no, they're thing was developed in 1984 or something, and I already had the patent, so there wouldn't be any problem. When it came to marketing, I wanted to give this to somebody else to market.
Mm-hmm.
The marketing is a whole big problem, you know, deal, and I wasn't interested in it. There was a couple in Belleville who had developed a game and couldn't find anybody to market it. And so they had started doing that themselves.
Mm-hmm.
However, it would cost me $100,000 up front. And I had already done much of the stuff they would be doing. And all, you know. And the thing that really clinched it, they had two other games they were working on. And so it would be at least 1 or 2 years before they'd be able to do it. And, you know, I mean, everything just kind of piled up as though, hey, forget it. I was tired, and I... So, this is my gift to the world.
To that.
End all wars and make everybody harmonious. Carl Rogers' theory is that everybody develops in a changing world, and sees things from his own frame of reference, uh-huh. and this for him is reality.
Mm.
And if you're going to help them mm-hmm. therapeutically, you have to understand his frame of reference.
Uh-huh.
And that's where that game board comes with, the mm-hmm. frame of reference. Point of view on either end.
Uh-huh.
And you'll notice there's a yellow and a blue sheet of plastic, and when they overlap, that becomes mm-hmm. green.
Uh-huh.
So, that would be an area of mutual understanding. Mm-hmm. And then you can't ever completely understand a person's frame of view unless you've lived their life.
That's right.
So it stops short of going to the end of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Carl Rogers spoke at Webster University when I was with the nursing division.
Mm-hmm.
And Lucille McClelland mm-hmm. was dean?
Yes, she was.
Okay. Anyway, she told me about it, and she offered to take my game and see if he would take a look at it.
Uh-huh.
So she took it to she was going to that conference that he was, or it was a speaking engagement that he had, and she was going, so she took it there, and she gave it to someone who was hosting Carl Rogers and mm-hmm. who had worked with him, and that person wrote me a real nice letter
yeah.
and said that he wasn't feeling well at the time. I think wasn't too long before he finally died.
Uh-huh.
He had something, and she said so he was only doing what had been scheduled.
Uh-huh.
But she looked over the game and all, and mm-hmm. gave me a very encouraging letter.
Oh.
I thought that was nice.
Hmm.
Let's see. I
asked if you remembered the Mississippi River Festival.
Yes, I certainly do. And that was... Festival. It was folk singers mm-hmm. and the symphony.
Mm-hmm.
As I understand, it was started as a summer home for the
mm-hmm.
St. Louis Symphony. And we would take blankets and sit out on the hillside there. And I just thought it was wonderful. I asked my son, one of my sons, who called yesterday. If he remembered the
uh-huh.
Mississippi River Festival, and he said, "Yes, I do. There were rock bands," and so he went. Couldn't quite remember the whole family going.
Uh huh.
You know, and I think probably we might have had one or two of the kids with us, but they had their groups
mm-hmm.
and they weren't sitting with us on the
uh-huh.
hillside. and then they continued to go. I think after mm-hmm. we didn't, and. The Mississippi River Festival, I thought, deteriorated
mm-hmm.
into a rocker. It was wonderful at the beginning, and I thought it really should have been supported all the way along.
Mm-hmm.
You also asked about the relationship of SIU to communities.
Yes.
mm-hmm. When we came, we were told that there was some hostility.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that at the time... they hadn't even decided where the entrance would be, or it wasn't put out for the public
mm-hmm.
for the campus. But evidently some dignitaries were flying over the area in a helicopter, and a farmer came out with a gun and shot
right.
at them. You know?
Yes.
Okay, so we had heard that, and we had also heard that, we might run into some hostility.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I was at a social gathering of someone who didn't know I had any relationship to SIU. And she started talking about the new university that was coming, and she said, and their tuition is going to be, and it was quite low.
Yeah.
And all. And she said, now anyone can go to college. And she thought that was terrible. And I looked at her and I thought, wow, it was like having your world turned upside
oh, yeah.
down. I thought it was wonderful.
Uh-huh.
And so I realized there was a difference of opinion there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. This was in Alton, and I think that some of the people in Alton had thought that, and some of them sent their children to Northeastern schools. Ivy League was a very thing to do. And I think they looked at education as a status symbol rather than as a practical good thing. Oh, and I also realized that several of the younger students, even if they were non-traditional, although there were a lot of local non-traditionals too, who weren't as old as I was, but they were out of school for high school for a few years. And I remember one young man especially who was working at the steel mill, and I think they changed shifts, rotated, and so every 2 weeks he would have a night shift. And he had told me he was working in the hottest part of it. I don't know what you're doing in the hottest part, but anyway, he would come to class and he would be so tired when he was on nights. And I realized he was falling asleep halfway through class.
Yes.
Students tend to learn how to manage to keep their neck straight or something.
Yeah, I know.
But you can still tell their eyes glaze over. So I started taking carbon paper and putting it under my notes, and then I would give him a copy of the notes afterwards. But it made me realize that some of the students there were making a very big effort to go to school. It was quite serious for most of them. This wasn't your usual campus. I sometimes wonder now, with the residence halls and all, if this won't change. You'll certainly have a more cohesive student group, and there will be a lot more extracurricular activities. For me, it was just right that it was a commuter campus.
Right.
And people pretty much went there for classes and study and left.
I think there is some concern now because the new president wants to make it into U.S. News and World Report best colleges, and their measurement is the ACT level of the people who come in. So, and then we're getting more residence halls, and so what we're going to end up doing is probably what we could end up doing, which I hope we don't, but is probably excluding a lot of people from this region. And I think that there should be some community organizing on that principle. I know there's concern because other people I've interviewed who actually were concerned about. I mean, some of your today, it maybe one of your kids might have chosen to go there because it's got really good programs. And to be a presidential scholar there, you're treated like royalty. You get in these little tiny classes with very good teachers.
Well, and I think the campus is excellent.
Yes.
I have visited a number of other schools where...
The Trek.
And where they've had to be in the middle of a residential or urban neighborhood, and they have one building here, one building there, and it's scattered, and it's not good. Even Harvard, is that way. And so, I think this was wonderful that SIU was started with so much space to expand. And also that, I'll call it Student Union, what's it called now? Morris Center, okay. That won an architectural award, and I think rightly deserved. It's a beautiful campus, and I think it's very conducive to study and to learning.
Yes.
And I really think there's so much that's very interesting now. I think it's a really exciting time to be learning. I mean, stem cell research.
Yes.
String theory of the universe. I mean, things are going out in all directions.
That's right.
I think it's a very exciting time.
I agree. Well, I asked if you've been active in the Alumni Association.
I was a member right after I graduated, and for several years, but frankly, I didn't become active. At the beginning, I really appreciated that I could have a library card, or I could have access to the library.
Yes.
And I used that quite a bit. I went over to the library quite a bit, but as the years went by, became less and less, and I didn't renew.
Well, are there any other themes? This was really interesting. It's wonderful. In the presidential files, Now wrote to the president of SIU on a number of occasions about different issues. Do you remember that?
I don't really remember that. I do remember that Now was very, we had a lawyer in the group.
Mm-hmm.
What's her name? They moved away. But she was very involved in Title IX.
Uh-huh.
And I think Now brought a suit against the school for Title IX and won.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I was asked to talk to a group of, I think, sixth graders or so a few years after that. Mm-hmm. And when maybe I was president now then. But anyway, the teacher asked me to mention that. Mm-hmm. And I remember telling the students that the reason they had such a good deal now on women's sports was because of Title IX and Now.
I think nowadays that a school teacher who invited the president of Now to speak to their class would probably feel enormous pressure, if not be censored.
The rise of the far right, I've been watching that from the time they were a minority for a while. As they were starting up in the GOP, in the Republican Party, and then taking it over and then progressing on. And it has been...
Did it turn it off? I can leave it on.
Okay,
I can leave it on because then we can cross
if this is just going to you, that's...
No, this is going to the Lovejoy Library.
Okay, I better stop.
Oh, well, then I'll turn it off.